13. Living in some interesting times, aren't we? This last month, a company put an AI program into a robot to make an android and then made that android a CEO of their company. Kind of crazy, sad, taking a high-paying position that could go to somebody that have family, have some actual creativity, have some moral standing, a conscience, and giving it to a robot. Another thing I saw in the news this week was kind of interesting. They were interviewing Netanyahu and asked him about the peace process and the treaty that they were about to sign. He says it's all on hold, but when we win this war over Gaza, Israel will be more ready for a peace than ever before. And, we think of all of the prophecies that God has in store for Israel, and we know that at one point the Antichrist is going to make a peace treaty with Israel. Revelation chapter 13. So we're looking at the verses that have to do with Jesus Christ in the book of Revelation. We won't actually get to that verse until we come to chapter 14, but I think it's important to keep it in perspective and to understand it to see what's going before it. We want to remember that we're in a parentheses segment of the book that will run through chapter 14 before it returns to the judgments that are being poured out. We saw last week the woman with child and the great dragon, and we're saying how we're getting a different perspective, maybe a little bit broader view of the same subject matter. We're seeing all of the key players and kind of putting them again in relationship to one another and some of the things that are going to be taking place during that tribulation period. We're going to see that especially here in chapter 13. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising out of the sea, having seven heads and 10 horns, on his horns 10 crowns, and on his head a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet were like the feet of a bear, his mouth like the mouth of a lion. The dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority, and I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast. So they worshiped the dragon, who gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him?" And he was given a mouth speaking great things, blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. It was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. All who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. He who leads unto captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. And we'll stop there for a moment. Last time we saw the great dragon, and we noted how all of the names for the devil were applied to that. Now we see another beast that has come up. He's given power, and we can see that that is the Antichrist. We see here that all of the world is going to turn to the Antichrist to worship him. And he's going to have signs and lying wonders that are going to deceive the people. One of those would be that he's going to receive a mortal wound and be healed from it. And so that has kind of the idea of being killed and brought back to life. And so he kind of stands as that false Christ who's coming and offering peace and salvation, and he has been put to death and brought back to life. He's living. He survived this mortal wound, and it was marvelous. It was such that the people of the world are going to be drawn to him because of these wonders that he's going to perform, to the place that all of the world is united in worship. And that is something that has been the purpose of Satan for a long time. What is it that Satan desired that brought about his fall? See, he was created a holy angel, and something happened that brought him to judgment. Pride, and in that pride, he wanted what? He wanted to be God. He wanted to be in the place of God. And God is worshipped. And ultimately, when all things are brought to its conclusion, he's going to have the only position of power, authority, and worship. Now, Satan has lusted after that position, and he is trying to recreate it here on earth. And even today, we have a lot of movement in the direction of bringing the faith organizations together. And you had the World Council of Churches and all of these different things, compromises on the part of evangelicals and the Catholic Church and outright paganism. They're coming together, they're trying to, but right now the genuine faith of believers is not allowing that to happen. There is the Holy Spirit that is in his church, not within the apostate church, but in his church, that is restricting that. And so it's not going to come together until the Holy Spirit and the true believers are removed. And then these lying wonders are going to deceive the people of this world, and they are going to worship Satan and his earthly puppet. And that's the Antichrist. And the Antichrist is going to have a false prophet that is going to further that worship. We get to verse 10, and I wanted to touch on this because it is a concept there that is repeated in chapter 14. And in studying verse 10, it would probably be better to understand those that are destined to captivity shall go into captivity. Those that are destined for the sword will go to the sword. And this is God's determined counsel, that he is in control, even though all of these things look like they're entirely out of control. Judgment is coming. And he says that this is the patience and the faith of the saints. They're going to be going through immense tribulation and persecution and martyrdom. And what is going to sustain them throughout the tribulation period, those genuine believers who won't bow the knee, they won't get the mark of the beast, life is going to be exceptionally difficult for them. And what sustains them is knowing the end, that God has determined judgment, that judgment is falling, it is going to happen, that those that are, some are determined to go into captivity, some are determined to go to the sword, and so forth. And so we have this absolute confidence that God is in control. It's going to happen out as God had planned it to. So verse 11, then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. And he exercised all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. So here we have the false prophet. He performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by a sword and lived. He's going to make an image of the beast. You know, years ago, that would give us the impression of something that was maybe carved out of wood or crafted in metal or some kind. But today, we can kind of get a different picture of what could be an image. As I just mentioned, the android that can look at you, talk to you, process information and stuff, and yet it's not living. It's just going to be an image of a man. It's not a real man. That's just speculation. That's not necessarily what's taking place here, but it is interesting to think about. So he's deceiving. All the world has come after him. Verse 16, he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. His number is 666. Then I looked, and behold, a lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his father's name written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven like the voice of many waters, and like the voice of loud thunder. And I heard the sound of harpists playing their harps. They sang, as it were, a new song before the throne, before the four living creatures and the elders. And no one could learn that song except the 144,000 who were redeemed from the earth. These are the ones who were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These are redeemed from among men, being first fruits to God and to the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no deceit, for they are without fault before the throne of God. So we can gain a little bit of appreciation for those Old Testament saints who were trying to sort through some prophecies. A lot of times we can look back at those Old Testament prophecies with hindsight. 2020, it's pretty easy to see it. It's clear. It says this, and there it was fulfilled, and we see very clearly the connection. We get into prophecies of the future, and it's not always quite as clear. We sometimes can get a pretty good picture of the big picture, but as we look at some certain elements of it, things get a little fuzzy. We're not entirely sure what some of these things mean. There's a lot of different opinions on a lot of this. And so as we look here, I think that this places a contrast with the chapter before. In chapter 13, we have the apparent victory of Satan and his Antichrist. All of the world is turned after him. All of the world is unified in worshiping him. And get to chapter 14 and says, this is the reality. There is going to be a remnant of genuine believers in the tribulation period. And we've seen part of that described previously in chapter 7, the 144,000. And we see here Jesus Christ on Mount Zion with 144,000. So Where is this? Some would say that this is in heaven. Others are saying it's on earth. And I think the language, the Greek words here, point to the fact that this is a picture of Christ on earth with his 144,000. The term from is not the same term as used in chapter 5 and verse 9 when you see them at the in heaven at the throne of God, where it is the idea of having come out of the earth. So they are still in the earth. They are sourced from people on earth, still on earth. So then you have to figure out, okay, is this just a picture of Christ supporting and protecting his people during the tribulation, or have we kind of jumped to the end of the picture here? And we've noted that this parentheses period is not necessarily chronological in order. We're seeing main ideas. And we've just seen the presentation of the victory of the devil, but is now putting it in context that victory is only for a moment. That Jesus Christ is going to come again. He's going to be on earth. He's going to be in the midst of his people, the 144,000 Jewish people that were sealed. And that idea of being sealed is that they are under God's protection. There were going to be others that are born again and are martyred. Let's go back to, I think it's chapter 7. In the end of chapter 6, we saw the fifth seal and the martyrs that are believers during the tribulation period that give their life for their faith. Then the next picture we see there is the sealed of Israel in chapter 7. The 144,000 broken up into each of the tribes there. And then in verse 9, you have a multitude from after these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude which no one could number, of all nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes, with palm branches in their hands, crying out with a loud voice, saying, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." So there's going to be many believers, but there is some distinction made with these 100,000. And I'm not entirely sure what all that entails. Some look at that 144,000 as being the witnesses that go out and testify, that produce the multitudes of all of the nations that are going to trust in Christ. As we look at our text, surely part of that multitude is going to involve other Jewish people. And yet there's this 144,000 of Jews divided up into each tribe that have this special position before God, before the Lamb. We see them in victory here. They are rejoicing. There's song, there's harps, and they are able to sing a new song before the throne in verse 3. It's a song that no one else can learn. Isn't that kind of interesting that those that are saints that go through the tribulation period have a unique position before God? They're not a part of the church, per se, because the church starts at Pentecost and ends at the rapture. But there were believers before the church, and there's going to be believers after the church, and each segment of believers have a special place in God's plan. And here, this is a group of those believers who are going to be with Christ as he rules and reigns on earth, and they have a special song because they've experienced things that nobody else has experienced. There's never been a time from creation to now that has had the absolute wrath of God poured out and believers living through that period of time. They have a special relationship to God, and they have a song to sing that nobody else is going to be able to sing. It tells us that they were ones that are not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. This causes us a little bit of a problem because the 144,000 is feminine in the Greek language, and there's really nothing in the previous mention of the 144,000 that would say that they were all men. And so what is this aspect of virginity and not being defiled by women? Now, at what point is this literal, or is this pointing, you know, this is a vision, this is giving us a type, a picture, is it speaking figuratively? Kind of things that are hard to sort out at this point. But it would seem like this is pointing back to chapter 13 and all of that false religion that was taking place in the world. These were not deceived by it. They kept their themselves pure from this false religion. They had been set apart unto God in a special way. So we see that they are the first fruits. These were the redeemed from among men, being first fruits to God and to the Lamb. When we look at first fruits, what are some other things that we think of? What other mentions of first fruits would help us understand this? Okay. Going back to the Old Testament law, and they had the whole aspect of the first fruits, and they were to go and take a small sampling of the crop and take it up to Jerusalem and bring it as an offering to the Lord and dedicate it to the Lord, and then they were to go back and finish their harvest, right? So as you look at that picture, the first fruits was kind of a promise of greater things to come. Jesus Christ is the first fruit of the resurrection, right? And so he was the first one, but that was the promise of much more resurrection to come. In fact, all resurrection, first the believers as well as the unbelievers in the day of judgment. So what is the first fruits is something that is somewhat representative. So we see this group of 144,000 probably standing in a representative position of many other believers that have come out of the tribulation time. They're distinct from the martyrs. They're distinct from the masses. They're distinct because of their purity. Okay, I think we've covered all of that. So we continue on. I guess before we continue on, we just, again, trying to think of Jesus Christ in the book of Revelation, we see him here as the ultimate victor. When Satan looks like he has won and has brought all worship to himself, ultimately, the true worship is going to come to Jesus Christ as the Lamb slain in the midst of his people. Verse 6, then I saw another angel flying in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach to those who dwell on the earth, to every nation, tribe, tongue, and people, saying with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs of water. And another angel followed, saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she has made all the nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. Then a third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, If anyone worships the beast and his image and receives his mark on his forehead or on his hand, he himself shall also drink the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out full strength upon the tormented with the fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night who worship the beast and his image and whoever receives the mark of his name. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. Then I heard a voice from heaven saying to me, Write, blessed are the dead who died in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors and their works follow them. We see Christ in here, in the midst of these angels, again placed over the judgment. It seems that the book of Revelation makes it a point that as judgment is being presented, it's almost always seen as coming from Christ or in the presence of Christ. And that gives us such a different perspective than what we may have thought of our Savior. And we'll see even more of that here in a moment. But the angels going forth proclaiming the everlasting gospel, gospel being good news, the everlasting gospel is probably not the message of the gospel that we would be familiar with. We live in the day of grace, and the gospel message that we hear is the message of grace. This one, the message has an emphasis of the coming judgment, that this coming judgment is imminent. It's going to happen at any moment. And they are giving opportunity to repent in that. We see that, that one of the angels cries out that Babylon is fallen. And this is demonstrates again that we're in a parenthesis, because you get to chapter 18, you have the fall of Babylon. So that will come in time there. We also see there the judgment on all that would take the mark, and it is a torment. There's going to be a great torment while they are on earth, but this demonstrates a torment that goes beyond that, and that it's in the presence of Christ that this judgment is coming. Verse 14, Then I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and on the cloud sat one like the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. And another angel came out of the temple, crying with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, Thrust in your sickle and reap, for the time has come for you. Time has come for you to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. So he went. So he who sat on the cloud thrust in his sickle on the earth, and the earth was reaped. So we have another image of Jesus Christ. Something like visions, things can change very rapidly, just kind of like in a dream. In one minute, you have Jesus Christ in his glory. The next minute, you have him as the slain lamb. And in the next minute, we have him standing in a cloud as a king. And that picture here, the white cloud, emphasizing his righteousness again. There's no sin in him. As he brings judgment upon the wicked people of this earth, he is not sinning. It is absolutely pure. It's absolutely just. It is absolutely right that these things should happen. And he has been so full of long suffering through this age of grace But all of this wickedness is being stored up for a day of judgment. And it's absolutely righteous for Jesus Christ to bring that reaping. And so the angel coming out of the temple, crying with a loud voice. And so it gives us the imagery that an angel coming from the presence of God the Father to God the Son, telling him now's the time. And then there's another angel that was mentioned as coming from the altar. And I don't remember where that was, but that would picture the prayers of the saints. And so we have really all of heaven, all of the angels and the saints and God the Father all calling for this moment of judgment. He is the Son of Man in righteousness and authority. He's wearing a crown. He is the King. And nobody stays his hand. Nobody tells him what to do. Nobody gives him counsel. The God the Father says it's time, and he has the full authority to do what needs to be done. And he has the sharp sickle in his hand. There seems to be two reapings here, and it causes some conflict among those that study this. Are they both judgment reaping, or is the first reaping a separation of the righteous, and the second judgment upon the sinners? It's kind of hard to imagine a sharp sickle and reaping the saints. But you can kind of make an argument for that. You go back to, I think it's in Matthew, when Jesus is giving his teachings on the end times, where he talks about the angels coming and capturing away. And there's a separation that is taking place. And it's not the rapture that was being described, because it was a judgment. The wicked were the ones that were being snatched. And where are they going? They're going to where the bodies are going to be found, and that's where the birds are going to be circling. It's taking them to death. So there's this separation. He goes on another time, he's separating the sheep and the goats. And so maybe that is pictured here. I would tend to think that there's probably something that we don't know. He's describing, I think, two judgments. The first judgment is, it says that the harvest of the earth is ripe. And that word means to be overripe. That this is, you go out to the grapevine and they're already starting to turn into raisins. You waited too long, kind of the idea there. It's overripe. Time has come. And judgment has been put off. There's no reason not to harvest. Long suffering has taken place beyond measure. And so there's some sense in which this is overdue. You get down in the next group, and they use another word, fully ripe, in the end of verse 18. That is that grape that is prime. It is at its peak of juiciness. And so when it's harvested and stepped on, juice just squirts everywhere. Okay? So let's read that. Then verse 17. Then another angel came out of the temple, which is in heaven, he also having a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the altar, who had power over fire, and he cried with a loud cry to him who had the sharp sickle, saying, thrust in your sharp sickle and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. So the angel thrust his sickle into the earth, and gathered the vine of the earth, and threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God, and the winepress was trampled outside the city. The blood came out of the winepress up to the horses' bridles for 1,600 furlongs. Again, the picture changed kind of rapidly there. In the first reaping, you have Christ doing the reaping. The second reaping, an angel is reaping, and somebody else is treading out the grapes. And we know that Jesus Christ is the one that treads out the grapes of the wrath of God. And so he's moving around in this picture here. So it's, we want to make sure to follow that. Such great wrath and judgment is coming that it says that the blood is going to flow up to the horses' bridles for 1,600 furlongs. 1,600 furlongs. How far is a furlong? How far is 1,600 furlongs? Does anybody have an idea? About 200 miles. How big is Israel? Top to bottom is less than 200 miles. And so there's again trying to figure out what does this mean? Is this to be taken literally? That's a lot of blood. 200 miles of blood. I don't know if you can get that much blood out of all the people on earth. I haven't looked it up to see if that's even possible. And to have it flowing up to the horse's bridle. So there's those that would say that this may be a picture of squirting blood, that like stepping on a juicy grape and it squirts out there and it gets on somebody. You ever eat something juicy and you take a bite and you're, the person sitting next to you gets it? Squirt! Oh! That's maybe what is described here, that the wrath of God is so severe in treading out the grape, and the grape is so ripe that it just bursts and is extended over the whole land. And so there's nothing that's going to escape it. And the central element is God returning to his people Israel and vindicating them, and his 144,000 and the first fruits of the tribulation, these individuals that are going to come through and populate the millennial kingdom, God is vindicating them, and the judgment is going to take place outside of the city of Jerusalem, which again draws us back to the time of the Battle of Armageddon. It doesn't actually happen at Jerusalem, but it happens further to the north, and that is the final culmination of the tribulation period when Christ comes back and just completely annihilates everyone in that battle. So, what is there here for us? It's an encouragement to know that God is in control. He has a plan. That when wickedness happens to us, it's not forgotten. That he is going to vindicate us. That there is a patience for the saints as we keep our eyes on the end. Keep our eyes looking to the end of things. That Jesus Christ is going to bring all things to a culmination. And we are able to endure as we keep our eyes on Christ. What we're going through now is nothing in comparison to what these saints are going to be going through. And yet Christ is going to be sufficient for them. If he's sufficient for them, he'll be sufficient for me as I go through the trials and difficulties of my life.